Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another edition of the Science Forum. We've got a panel of experts ready to go to field your scientific questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If anything has been puzzling you in the scientific realm, we'd like to hear it. 800-348-2551, within reason. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's another way to contact the show, but the number is, and it's a call-in show, 800-348-2551. Scientists are here. You are there. Let's meet. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. Our experts are here. They're ready to go. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question that has been bugging you, with us today, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett, and we are ready to roll. Hello, everybody.
Hello. Hey, everybody.
That was very good.
Welcome back from vacation.
Thank you very much. And I've already been told by Barbara that I need a sabbatical. And I just got back from 2 weeks off. I don't know.
It's just merely a suggestion.
Am I that cranky?
Hearing, merely a suggestion.
Hearing nothing, we move on. All right, we were sitting on the beach. We were at up in New York Beach, and we were right on the ocean and in front of our house. And my wife and I were having a drink, water. And we're thinking about how the tides were very tepid, not too big and not too aggressive this year. And in years past, you know, they've been fairly large, but this year, there was a new moon. And so my question was, anecdotally, we seem to believe that anytime there's a full moon, much bigger waves. And when there's a new moon, not big waves. Are we wrong, or is the science backing us up on this?
You're wrong.
Are we?
Yes, you are.
Okay, so
you can see the waves better when there's a full moon, but it doesn't make any difference whatsoever whether it's a new moon or
okay,
a full
because
moon.
The moon is still there. Right.
Right. The thing that controls the waves is the height of the moon in the sky and how close it is to the Earth. If the moon is directly overhead, then the tide is right there and it's going to be relatively strong. Of course, it also depends on where the sun is with respect to the moon, because if the two are away from each other, that's called a neap tide. If the two are parallel to each other, it's called a spring tide. So that controls also the height of the moon. But basically, how high up the moon is in the sky makes a big, big difference.
All right. Fair enough. And you know what? It was very handy because for the first time in going up there 20 years now, I did not once put my boogie board nose first into the sand and go tumbling over like Evel Knievel. Mm. So they were just tame enough for me. Mm. By the way, before we get going with the emails and the calls here, Jim Pickett, you said you had some nerdy chemistry news for us.
Yeah, in chemistry and engineering news, to do with an article published in Nature, making ammonia is a really important thing because it feeds about 3/4 of the people on the Earth.
Yeah.
For fertilizer. Making ammonia, however, requires high temperatures, high pressures, and lots of natural gas to make hydrogen. It was announced that an electrochemical way has been found to make ammonia with very high efficiency. Now, the trick in making ammonia is you've got to break a nitrogen-nitrogen bond from nitrogen gas. And that is, if not the strongest, one of the strongest bonds in chemistry.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of energy to break it. But if you put an electron in, things are just being just right, you can get it to break. So apparently, they got the efficiencies very high in these cells. And then rather than having to have this humongous heavy-duty factory to make ammonia, it can be made in an electrochemical cell that you could hold in your hand.
Wow.
So it's scalable down. So that means if this all works out, because there are thousands of things that could go wrong, but if it worked out, then it would be scalable down so that locales could have this production facility that could use excess renewable energy from a wind turbine when you didn't need the extra energy or solar cells. Because it's easy to compress and store liquid ammonia. Plus, it's a way to transport hydrogen for a hydrogen economy. So there's all sorts of advantages to ammonia, but there are some downsides. It being flammable and pretty toxic.
Yeah, there's that.
Smells nasty. But a lot of ammonia gets transported around today and with relatively little consequence. So it's a big deal if it works out.
Aren't I producing ammonia under my armpits every day?
Yep.
Probably.
Yeah, so why don't you just make a giant armpit?
Hard to scale.
We've seen The Matrix. We don't use people to run biological processes generally.
Oh, okay.
So are you skeptical that this will actually come to fruition, Jim?
Well, it's just, I mean, if you want to bet whether a good idea will work out in the end or not, you always vote no. Because most fail somewhere along the line.
A pessimist is never disappointed.
Exactly. Right. But some of them do succeed, and you never know.
Speaking of foul smelling, this email came in.
Are we setting a theme already?
Subject heading, this is from Anonymous. I don't know who this is. Smelly stuff to keep kids and dogs out. And here's what Anonymous said. I need a do-it-myself recipe, formula, or chemicals for the most foul-smelling skunk level or higher spray, granules, or powder that will last more than a few hours outdoors to stop my neighbors, four kids, plus friends, from running, playing in my garden, trampling on my ground plants, pollinator plants, fences not allowed, parents don't care or watch their kids. Wow.
Well, Ed and I were just having lunch together ahead of time, and there was a certain sandwich concoction that our lunch guest had said that really kept his office on their heels.
Yeah.
So perhaps Ed would like to explain what the concoction was.
I believe it was a combination of sardines, Limburger cheese,
and raw onion.
And raw onions.
Oh, come on. Who's going to eat this?
No, on white bread, yes.
And they would put it in a microwave.
To warm it up.
Wow, it's not quite break time, but I think I'm going to be ill.
It would clear the floor.
But, I mean, you can't do that.
He was banned from using the microwave at work.
I mean, is there something that this obviously bitter person could do to keep the kids out of the garden?
Well,
fences are not an option.
Yeah, he didn't say about super soakers. There's always that.
Kids love super soakers.
Well, I meant being the target of super soakers. But
I'd suggest carpacin. I'd suggest
capsaicin.
Capsaicin. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a hot pepper extract. What makes your tongue burn?
But wouldn't that actually harm the children? I mean, I don't think this person wants to harm the children.
Only once.
Yeah, and although it feels like you're going to die, you actually don't. And it doesn't cause physical damage.
All right.
I was working once in a
plant. Once you were working?
Well, yes.
And he's retired.
I didn't like it and never did it again. But where they extracted chili peppers and got the capsaicin out of chili peppers. And I was doing my little project, minding my own business. And at the dryer next to me, they were hosing it down to clean it out. And I got wafted with capsaicin.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on fire for about 2 hours.
Wow. Okay. So this is not
It's not a bad question. You know, sriracha is a big hit.
Yeah.
And it's made in the southern U.S. And in this town, and I teach water chemistry, and sriracha and water chemistry, they kind of go together but don't go together. What happened is that the effluent that was coming from the sriracha plant was diffusing into the natural water supply that was a lake, a reservoir. And so when you took the groundwater and sent it through people's pipes, or surface water through people's pipes, and then delivered it, it had a sriracha kick to it.
Oh.
Because of the simple diffusion, good old Henry's law, from the air to the surface of the lake.
And they were going to close the plant because of that.
Yes, they were sued by the local establishment, which, of course, had a good tax base to have the sriracha plant there. But, you know, they were sick of everything tasting like sriracha.
But I think to answer the lady's question, that the thing to do would be to go to the garden store. You can get spray that's deters
kids.
Yeah, well, there's a well, there's deters a coyote urine spray.
Yeah, deer and rodents.
Yeah,
and it does have the rotten eggs.
It's pretty awful. If she wants to enjoy it though, she'd have to wait for after a rainfall, because after a rainfall it does wash that away, and then you have to reapply.
This is really taking a dark turn already. It's very, I mean, keeping kids out of gardens with very painful pepper spray.
I was on the sardines kick myself. I thought the smell would just kind of waft and keep them away.
And right. On top of that, you're using it to improve your garden.
Fertilize.
Right? Well, along those lines, Elizabeth writes in, Elizabeth
along
Troy
those lines.
With squirrels. Wonderfully beneficial show. Odors carried by molecules in the air. And are we breathing in a few bad things when we smell the litter box or weed killer sprays that are improperly used? That's from Elizabeth, who is in Troy with the squirrels.
Well, I'm known as Body Fluids Barb in other localities.
That one of your nicknames?
It's one of my
true.
Nicknames at work.
Okay.
Yeah. So what you're smelling from a litter box are the volatile organics or ammonia-like molecules that are coming off of a cat litter box. For the most part, you're not going to have bacteria that's suspended in the air or some virus that they might have that you're going to breathe in. But the ammonia is
ammonia,
a pretty
yes.
potent smell. Here we are back to ammonia. And that's going to be, when urea breaks down, that's what it's going to give, is that ammonia. That's why you never use bleach when you clean a litter box, because it's going to react with the ammonia that's locked into the plastic of that litter box. You should use an enzyme-based entity that's going to break down the proteins that contain the urea or the ammonia, have the ammonia adhered, hydrogen bonded, if you will, to the outside of the proteins, and that will help to break down this smell.
As compared to producing chlorine gas.
Well, chloramides, which are even worse, which are toxic.
Yeah. And I think it's a matter of, again, the dose making the poison.
Sure.
The amount, I mean, you get enough ammonia, you die.
Right.
But the ammonia that you would get from
a litter box?
From a litter box is going to just make you disgusted.
All right.
Well, unless you have asthma. There are some reactive asthmas that you can have, an asthma that's triggered by certain smells, including things like urea or ammonia.
Well, we're off to a very different start here. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill, and Jim Pickett. He's retired, but he's still very smart. We'll be back. Good stuff. It's Fox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets here to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get to your phone calls in a minute. One last email, and this is from James. When you are hungry and your stomach rumbles, what causes that sound and feeling?
Great question. Like your heart, your digestive system, which runs from mouth to bottom, has a basic movement that runs pretty much all the time. In fact, if you've ever gone to the doctor's office and they've given you a physical, after they listen to your heart and lungs, they'll probably put the stethoscope on your belly to hear normal bowel sounds. And that's the rumbling that happens just as a matter of case. And anywhere from, say, 3 to 10 constrictions per minute happen, and it moves from the mouth side in a wave down towards the bottom side, and that's called peristalsis, right? We use peristalsis to help us swallow. It also helps move our food from our stomach into our small intestine through the sphincters that exist. And that rhythm has a pretty set pace. But like your heart rate, during certain events in your GI tract, your peristaltic rate will go up. So this basic electrical pulse that becomes a muscular contraction changes when you're about 2 or so hours out from a meal. And the reason why that is your stomach should have emptied about 2 hours in, and it really wants to kind of clear the chamber, so to speak, to get ready for the next bout.
Yeah.
You've got cells in there that have to regenerate. You've got hydrochloric acid that it's got to be ready to give out. And it doesn't want to be coated in mucus or whatever you swallow in between meals. So it's going to just kind of do a pre-clean. And that's what we hear is that that stomach growl. And the growling is really more of, you know, an empty system, like going through this normal peristaltic rhythm, albeit a little faster. But it's mostly small intestine you're hearing. It's actually very infrequently your stomach.
Okay.
Because your stomach just kind of collapses into itself.
Let's go to our phone lines here on the Science Forum, and we go to Steve in Albany. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I'm just wondering, everything is made up of internal things that are constantly bouncing around. I mean, quantum theory, nothing is steady. And yet somehow my desk doesn't go anywhere. I don't understand that. Doesn't spontaneously bounce.
Yeah, that's because all that little wiggling is going on in a teeny tiny scale, and we're too big to detect it. So if you scrunch down, looked closely enough, you would see the surface vibrating a little bit. Now, the whole table isn't going to jump up and move. It's just a matter of the atoms will move tiny little bits relative to themselves.
But couldn't it spontaneously synchronize, and then all those tiny movements would result in a big movement?
Yes, but the odds of that happening are so small that it wouldn't happen in the lifetime of the universe.
Well, and those movements are 10 to the minus 15 per second, you know, 10 to the 15 per second.
Yeah.
So even if it did jump, by the time that you could perceive it, it would have jumped somewhere else, likely back towards its original state.
Right. As my old professor used to say, it would be equivalent to having all the oxygen atoms in the room show up in one corner of the room all at one time, and so you don't have anything to breathe. It's just something that couldn't possibly happen because it's so random in operation.
Yeah.
And the kind of macro scale, we call this Brownian motion, you know, the movement of electrons around nuclei and then the movement of nuclei relative to one another. You can watch Brownian motion happen, like the typical demo that we give for Brownian motion, which is kind of a bit fake, but I'll give it to you, is you take a beaker of clear water, distilled water, and you put a drop of really heavy dye in. The dye will sink to the bottom because of gravity to the bottom of the flask, and then you leave it there for 15, 20 minutes, and ultimately it will diffuse throughout the liquid. So liquids diffusing in liquids happen because, and it happens until we have what is we call a homogeneous liquid or a mixture where we have the dye pretty much everywhere. And that's just random. It's random movement of those atoms until we achieve this, not until we achieve this homogeneous state, but we end up with this homogeneous state. And then they're still moving, even though it's homogeneous. It's, you know, distributed the same throughout. It's harder to do solids, but you can diffuse a solid into a solid. Liquid or gases to gases, as Ed said, like oxygen and air, you know, that's going to happen faster because those molecules are more kinetic. They're moving more relative to one another in the gaseous state.
And the classic Brownian motion itself was jiggling of pollen grains in water,
okay,
observed through a microscope. And Einstein explaining that is what got him his Nobel Prize.
Uh-huh. Well, Steve, thank you for getting us started with that one. I appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Bravitz and Ed Stander here from SUNY. Are you getting ready for school?
Yeah, a little over 2 weeks.
That's exciting stuff, huh?
Can't wait.
Whole new group of students. Who knows?
You seem like maybe you're not quite as enthused as Barbara.
Oh, Barbara's always much more enthusiastic than I am. Right. I'm just more rational.
I'm in microbiology lab for 6 hours a week, which means goggles and masks and gloves and lab coat. So you won't see much of me except maybe the tip of my nose and maybe my hair.
And that's okay.
Everything else will be covered.
All right, fair enough. All right, let's go back to our phone lines here, and we go to Colin, who is in a car, apparently, and it sounds like it. Colin, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. First time caller. Thanks for having the show on. I was curious about how come small ants and, you know, and others can withstand much more G-forces than we do. I mean, a wasp slams into my window and continues flying, And if I did the same thing, I'll be taken to a hospital.
I like it. No one's answered.
Well, some of it has to do with
mass.
With mass, that there's relatively small amount of kinetic energy there to dissipate. Plus, things scale differently. Things generally are stronger on a small scale, just because you don't have a lot of mass to support. Now, with things falling, like an ant falling off the table, doesn't get smooshed because it has low mass, high air resistance, dropping, so it doesn't pick up much speed before it hits a surface.
There's also a biological reason, and that is insects have a chitinous outer body. They have an exoskeleton rather than an interior skeleton. So their mushy stuff is on the inside and their hard stuff's on the outside.
Kind of like Iron Man.
Kind of like Iron Man, pretty much, right? Or, you know, that classic Far Side cartoon where the polar bear, you know, eats the
igloo
and it's as crunchy on the outside, ooey and gooey on the inside.
Ah. Colin, you want to follow up?
No, I think the same thing with ants. I mean, I throw an ant from my heights, and it hits the floor and continues walking. So yep. It's just very, very curious that they are able to withstand much more G's than humans, let's say.
Well, the physics of it, force equals mass times acceleration. So the amount of force that they feel depends very much on how heavy they are and how fast they move. So when an ant falls from the table, again, the air resistance is going to slow him down, and there's so little mass that the force of the impact is very little.
Thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Sue in Delmar. Sue, you're on.
Hi. I have a situation where I'm a lover of thrift stores, and I ended up with a set of sheets that had a very strong mothball odor in them. I know that there's naphthalene and another type of chemical used in mothballs. I have washed them and aired them out in the yard several days. I've dried them after I've washed them in the dryer, and I cannot seem to get this odor out of this fabric. And I'm wondering if it is possible that they could just be permanent, if the odor or the chemical is still permanently set in the fabric. I don't smell it when the fabric is actually after it dries and cools, but if I wash it and put it back in the dryer again, after I've already soaked it in a lot of vinegar, I wash it and dry it again, then the odor comes back. And it's so strong that I can smell it in the center of the room on a rack. After I pull it out of the dryer. Is this something that's permanently set now in the fabric, or will I be eventually able to air it out?
A lot of it
depends.
Do
you have any clue?
On the fabric, would you consider them cotton, or are they a poly-cotton blend?
Yes.
They're cotton?
I'm pretty sure it's 100%.
Yep. Well, if it's a natural fiber, cotton. You have a shot.
Yeah. And the best thing to do would be to hang them, just hang them for a longer period outside.
Why does that make it better?
Well, because you'll be exposing maximum surface area by opening it out. You got some wind blowing, which will help get it away from. Basically, what's going to happen is the molecules, the naphthalene or dichlorobenzene, are pretty volatile. That's why you can smell them so easily.
You're pretty heavy, though, for organic molecules. Yeah. That's why they persist.
The fact that you continue to smell them means that they're getting away. Eventually they'll get away. And the best way to get them away would be hanging them out in the sun. We'll let the sun warm it up a little bit. If there's any breeze, then it'll get wafted away.
I actually have a different idea, Jim. I think she should have them dry cleaned.
Oh,
because if you dry clean them, you're going to use organic solvents. Ask them to use the good old-fashioned organic solvents that they have access to not wet them, but to spray
them.
On them. And then what will happen is that can capture those organics that are behind and then have them dissipate.
Yeah,
kind of like freeze drying.
Yeah, but the vinegar is doing nothing for you.
Yeah, vinegar's not helpful.
That's just wasting your time.
Now, regarding hanging them outside, could you take a shop vac to them and get those molecules off?
Well,
no, they have to go volatile, And that really takes the heat of the sun to
UV.
Get them going.
Or UV, UV will break them down,
and the UV will break them down, too.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sue.
My concern is that since I've dried it in a very hot dryer a few times, have I permanently set it in there?
No.
No.
Not if they're... If you told me they were a polycotton blend, I'd say yes. But because you're telling me that they're cotton or linen, then you have a shot, because there will not be a cellulosic reaction between the cellulose type particles that are the polymers that are in the sheet and these very differently reactive organics that you have. If you had a polymer sheet made out of polyester, for example, then you would get cross reaction, and then they're not coming off.
Yeah,
that's why polar fleece smells and has BO, and kind of you wash it and clean it up, and then you wear it for 10 seconds. It's like, ugh, it still stinks.
Okay,
that's a cross reaction between the plastic and then your odoriferous self that then gets
the
cross.
Sue, thank you for the
ammonia,
call.
Yes.
The number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. Joanna's in South Hadley. Joanna, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have what I think is a timely question following this heat wave, which is, I don't want to be using my AC, but I want to know your opinions about the best way to try to cool rooms without AC. What I've tried is putting like some foam core board against windows to try to reflect the incoming direct sunlight. And I've also used some fans, but I want your expertise. Would it help or hurt to put like a drying rack with wet towels on it in front of the fan? Does that help having the wetness? Are there any other kind of do-it-yourself ideas you can think of? Does moving the air around, simply moving it around, does that cool the air? Is it only like the tree falls in the forest only if you hear it of thing? Only if you're feeling the air.
The water on the sheets and moving around effectively is allowing you to cool by removing sweat. And as the sweat removes from your body, you're losing heat. But the way we do it at our house, and I can tell you for a fact that my wife never lets me use the air conditioning, is we keep the windows open at night, and then first thing in the morning, we close the windows. And the air at night keeps it warm, or keeps it cool in the building for most of the day. The other thing you can do, and it's been suggested, is during the night, you run your air conditioner. When it's cold outside, what you want to do is cool your house as much as possible with the least amount of loss out to the outside. And then during the day, that air conditioning that you ran during the night, which didn't cost very much, winds up keeping your house much cooler during the day.
Another suggestion, and the thermodynamics don't really play well, but it has to do with what you feel, right? Dehumidifying your house during the heat will make you feel cooler, even if it's the same temperature that it would be without air conditioning. What I think I find most pleasant about air conditioning is the fact that I'm not walking through a humid room, and that in and of itself is uncomfortable to me.
Yeah, the only problem with that is that a dehumidifier is effectively a reverse air conditioner. So
right, but it's a reverse air conditioner, but it's small. You can dehumidify a room for relatively little energy versus air condition a room to 70 degrees.
Yeah, the evaporation method called a swamp air conditioner.
Yeah, swamp cooler.
Swamp cooler. That's often used in hot desert areas because here we often get the heat and the humidity at the same time. And you would increase the humidity undesirably. Plus, it really wouldn't work very well if the humidity is already very high. Keeping the sunlight out is a good idea. Make sure whatever it is you put in the windows is reflective, either white or shiny, and so that it reflects the infrared back out rather than absorbing it.
Right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, but be careful when you do that because you can wind up producing an incredible amount of heat on the window, and I've seen them break as a result.
Oh, ooh.
Very interesting. Let's take a quick break here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett are here to answer your questions. We'll be back. ¶¶ Vox Pop on WAMC Science Forum today with Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. A few emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Dave in Monroe writes, my question is about how we measure the age of the Earth and other planets. If the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, what was here 4.5 billion years and one day ago? Surely the process of planet formation takes longer than a day, so how do we determine when a mass can be considered a planet? And that's from Dave in Monroe.
Well, the age of the Earth is determined on the basis of meteorites, because the oldest rocks on the Earth are way down and you can't get to them. So if you want to know how old it is, then what you do is you go to Antarctica and you pick up as many meteorites as you can, and you date those using uranium lead, which has a half-life of about 4.5 billion years. And almost every meteorite we've ever received from outside is that age. So we figure the meteorites probably formed at the same time as the planets.
And that there had to be a gravitational pull to pull that meteorite in. I mean, you just don't have a bunch of stuff end up in Antarctica by happenstance. It gets pulled in because that means we had to have a mass enough to have our own gravitational pull.
That's not quite true, since the meteorites probably landed much, much later than the Earth formed.
Ah.
So it's just the age of the meteorites and all these little pieces that come in from the asteroids or from other places are all giving about the same age. And that's about 4.5 billion years. So that's where we get the age.
Yeah, so the
dating it to the day, give or take 100 million years or so, right?
Right.
And how do we say a conglomeration of matter is a planet? When do we call it a planet as opposed to
a mess? We call it a planet when it's heavy enough that it no longer moves towards the sun.
Ah.
That's a great answer.
All right, this one's from Mary. At our vacation home, the seacoast of New Hampshire, Maine region, it seems we are getting more king tides flooding roads. Are these related to climate change? And that's from Mary in Wilbraham.
I think the short answer is yes. The sea level has been increasing steadily. Along shorelines, especially in northern areas where there have been glaciers, you also get effects of what can kind of cancel out.
It's called isostasy.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll let the geology talk about that. But anyway, things move up and down also kind of on their own. But it's likely that it's sea level rise. Other places, the main problem has been subsistence from pumping out too much groundwater.
Subsidence. Yes. So if you pump out the water underground, say on Long Island, for example, to feed your population, to wet your population, you're going to squeeze out the sponge and the sponge is going to get thinner. And so when you don't have that much clearance between high tide and the tallest part of the island, for example, everything gets lower and you start to lose the edges before you lose the middle.
Yeah, this one is from Will in Kingston. Is there any explanation as to why there are so few elements like mercury and bromine on the periodic table that are liquid at standard temperature and pressure?
Huh.
Well,
it's a thinking question.
The metals in general, like, are more stable, crystallized. So that of course, then will be a solid. And it's rather more remarkable that that mercury is a liquid.
Correct. And that you can find it in its elemental form anywhere. But you can find elemental mercury, in a rock formation in soils, for example.
Oh, but it's usually locked up.
Cinnabar. Yeah, most of it is locked up, but not all of it, right? Yeah. There's still some that's elemental mercury.
So the short answer is I don't remember. I think I remember reading about it, but I don't remember why mercury is actually a liquid. The next metal that comes close is gallium, which will melt at about body temperature.
Right.
Bromine
is not a metal,
but the halogens. I mean, the next up in the periodic table from bromine is chlorine, so it's a gas.
And
whereas
the
next one down
it,
is iodine, which is a solid but sublimes easily. It's easy to make
right.
it a
so
gas.
It's a bit of a Goldilocks issue with bromine.
So bromine is right there kind of between the gaseous element and the solid.
All right,
but it's also, I'll just say, bromine's also a molecule, right? It's Br2. Yeah. It's two bromines stuck together, and that's kind of its native habitat. So there are plenty of molecules that are liquids. Obviously, water is one of them. But bromine atoms are not liquid.
No.
All right, one more email for now, and then we'll get back to the phones. This is from our friend Tig in Chesterfield. Is the technology used to pressurize a vessel for space similar to building a vessel to survive high pressure underwater? Could a submarine be used as a spaceship or vice versa? Is one harder to design than the other? That's
what Ty. One of the problems is the direction that the pressure is applied. For example, if you're doing a pressure vessel for underwater, you want it to be round because the pressure is on the outside pushing in. When you're in space, you've got the pressure on the inside and it's pushing out. So a round vessel is nowhere near as useful in that situation.
Plus, the pressure is very low. It's,
right.
It's lower than atmospheric pressure because they run high oxygen.
Right. And then one of the big issues with space is mass. You got to get it into space. So, and that's how much fuel you need, how big your rockets are, is all proportionate to how much you're going to launch into space. When you're building a submarine, mass is not so much an issue. You can make it heavy. It'll still float if it's got enough air in it, if you make it big enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can get buoyancy with heavy objects. I mean, an elephant will float, and it's heavy. And
have you ever tried to float an elephant?
I haven't, but I've been on a submarine, if that's any consolation.
Cool. Oh, that's great.
Well, my husband was in the Navy, so.
What, he let you ride?
No, I worked.
Bring your wife to work day.
They didn't do that, no. But I worked for the Naval Submarine Medical Research Laboratory, and now I'm going to have to kill you all.
All right. Fair, and all of the listeners, so good luck with that. Let's go to Travis in Pittsfield. Travis, you're on.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I collect food waste from grocery stores and colleges and nursing homes and all stuff like that to keep it out of the landfill. And when I pick it up, usually it's this time of year, it's quite pungent. I mean, really bad. And so I'm constantly breathing that in. And I was just wondering if the breakdown of it is okay to ingest on a long-term basis.
Well, we talked about chloramines before when we were talking about ammonia and bleach reacting. Chloramines can be a byproduct of decomposition, especially given the fact that you have a variety of food wastes that are coming in. I would make sure that you have adequate ventilation, whatever space you're in, just because you need oxygen. And these gases that are coming off of this decomposing matter will push, you know, will fill up your space because it's an active process of diffusion. So I just worry about making sure you're in a well-ventilated area, as they'll say on the back of any kind of paint or whatever.
It's all outside. It's all outside.
Yes, as far as the toxicity.
Very good. Thanks for taking my call.
It's not toxic. No, it's more about displacing the oxygen, and you shouldn't end up with burns or any such thing from breathing in those gases.
Travis, thanks for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. David is in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
We missed you during your vacation. We hope you had a good time.
Well, I won't get another one for a year, so you'll get plenty of this.
You missed a good spirit show on Food Friday.
Oh, yeah, I booked it. I hope it was good. John Fisher's great. And I had my own spirit show up in Maine. So anyway, what do you got, David?
Well, while you were gone, there was a show about global warming, you know. And my comment is that global warming will not be solved until we solve the patent office problem. Because all these good ideas are being patented and bought up by companies that don't want to see them as competition for their own products. And I wanted to bring up a situation where water that generates electricity in New York State belongs to Central Hudson. So if somebody put a turbine into the water to generate electricity, clean electricity, they would be actually arrested for theft. And I just wanted to know what the scientific minds think about all this.
I'm not so if you divert water for any purpose, then you...
not just that, but the fact that patents of your ideas, you invented something scientifically, and a corporation just buys that idea from you, puts it on a shelf, and it's never used. And I think, you know, the patent law should be changed so that anything that would be of use to global warming would be able to be used.
Well, let me give you a counterpoint, David. I don't have to patent it. I can put it out in the literature and not patent it, and then the world has it to its effect. So when, you know, the commerce that's there is a, it's a commercial venture when you patent. I can still claim my idea by publishing it in peer-reviewed literature and then not monetize it.
Ah.
So there are alternatives, and nobody stops me. Nobody makes me patent an idea.
Yeah, and I'm not aware of that being actually an issue with companies buying up good ideas and then sitting on them. I would like to know actual concrete examples of that.
Well, you know what?
Because the owner of a patent can't be hidden. It's public.
Right.
It's public knowledge.
Hey, David, I tell you what. I noticed on the calendar before the show that we have a copyright form coming up at the end of the month. Why don't you save this one, do a little bit of research, get an example, and then give us a call toward the end of the month. I think it's on a Tuesday. I'm just going by memory, which is very poor. But thanks for the call. Let's go to New Jersey already. Jeff in Jackson, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thanks.
Yep.
I was reminded by your earlier discussion about animals and different animals being injured by falling. And I remember a scientific analysis I heard years ago where they focused on making the ratio of the surface area to the volume of any animal. And they use it to explain why, like, a spider doesn't mind if you drop it. And I remember they were so bold that they predicted that if you threw a mouse off the Empire State Building, that it would hit hard, but it would get up and shake and, like, run away.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go to the experimental committee to see to get approval for that one, but I recall reading a similar thing, Jeff, and yeah, I think that holds the math holds true.
Yeah, it said mass is everything. The squirrels can fall pretty far and not get injured, whereas chimpanzees have lots of broken bones.
Very interesting.
From falling.
It's a fat squirrel. Like, I remember we had a big oak tree in the backyard.
Squirrel
fell and died.
Fat squirrels will die and the skinny ones won't.
I had
of that
to bury
M,
the squirrel.
MA, yeah.
My kids were traumatized. Let's go to another place in New Jersey, Haddon Township. Gina, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
You bet. Go ahead.
Okay, so my 27-year-old who had his second bout of COVID was diagnosed with stage 1 diabetes, and the physicians all believe it's as a result of COVID. And I wondered if one of your experts could comment on how a virus can attack your pancreas and interfere with your insulin production.
Sure. So type 1 diabetes is a disease of inflammation. Your pancreas suffers because there's inflammation in your body, and then that inflammation takes what is a delicate organ and really makes it not work well or not at all. That's kind of type 1 diabetes in a very small public radio nutshell. COVID, in and of itself, the coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2 virus, has a heightened inflammatory response once it's detected by your body. It kind of it slips in and bypasses a lot of your basic immunological register. And then eventually it's seen. And then another immunological molecule really goes into overdrive. So that's why we see a lot of this effect of inflammation and irritation in the lungs that persists. We see these heart inflammation diseases that persist. And it's reasonable to assume, and it's just an assumption because I am not a physician, that type 1 diabetes, which is a disease of inflammation, would happen from inflammation as a consequence of an infection of COVID. So it's not the virus itself that kills the pancreas, but it would be the inflammation that sets up afterwards.
All right, Gina, thanks very much. A few minutes left here on the Science Forum. We go to our buddy Merle in Argyle. Hello, Merle.
Hi. This has to do with beta and in liquid. In other words, when I buy my feta from the local feta girl, boy, they serve it in a tub, and if the tub has enough fluid in it, it will stay active, good for a year. But if it's exposed at all, it'll start to mold.
And we're talking feta cheese, yes?
Yes, feta cheese. All right. The question is, how do you cut it to maintain, because you're going to take out volume out of the tub and still maintain a coverage over top of the feta?
Finally, a question about cutting cheese. All right, we only have about a minute here. What do you got, scientists?
I don't know what the typical time it would take for air-exposed feta to grow its own little farm. But my suspicion is it would take a couple of weeks. Usually for the materials that grow in cheese, the fungi and the bacteria, the beneficial bacteria that help cheese culture, are air loving. They need air. When you're underwater, there ain't a lot of air. So you're going to slow down those culturing bacteria from reproducing if they're submerged. Your question about how do I keep them covered? It's cut it from the top, not the side. It doesn't really matter because it's still going to be the same volume. Put it in a smaller dish.
I'd put two things here. First of all, cheese is a living creature, and the mold that you're seeing on there is probably, or could very well be, coming from the cheese itself. So what you're doing effectively is making your cheese older by having it there. And secondly, when we buy large cheese, not necessarily feta cheese, but larger wheels of cheese, what we do is we cover the surface that we've cut with butter. And what that does is it seals it with effectively the same material the cheese is made out of.
Yeah.
And that can keep it alive a lot longer.
You know what? This is perfect because tomorrow's Food Friday is all about cheese. So, Merle, thank you for a little forward promotion. Cut that out. Hey, Ed, Jim, and Barbara, thank you all for being here.
Sure thing.
And you professors enjoy
the last remaining vestiges of our...
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll talk to you next month. Support comes from Salem Farm Supply, carrying a stock of Kubota machinery and Kubota genuine parts with equipment for everyone, from farmers to homeowners. Locations in Salem and Claverick, New York. SalemFarmSupply.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction, VillaVeritas.org. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, resume, and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, CareersInTransitionLLC.com. Once again, thanks to Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here today. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls today. Tremendous emails. Thank you all. Thank you. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. As I mentioned, tomorrow we say cheese. We welcome Shalina Bridgham of Four Fat Fowl and Haley Whalen of Arthur's Market. Stand by now for something decidedly not cheesy.